Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA.
Before Darfur, Rwanda, or Burundi, there was the Nigerian Civil War. The bloodshed which followed the Biafran secession provided a horrific spectacle of uniformed troops acting brutally to subjugate and slaughter civilians. Because their targets were chosen by ethnicity, and because their methods were draconian, the atrocities which took place in Nigeria's Midwestern states in October 1967 are rightly called Africa's first black-on-black genocide. Now that the specter of genocide haunts conflicts in today's Africa, as in Kosovo and Bosnia, it is essential to understand just what happened in a brutal war 40 years ago. My guest is Emmanuel Okocha, author of Blood on the Niger, the first black-on-black genocide. Emmanuel, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you.
Very nice coming in here. Very respected institutes and very well recognized by our power brokers in Africa.
Well, thank you so much. This book also is quite nice. In fact, nice. Well, let me qualify that. It's an important book because this book is a carefully researched account of what happened in the town of Asaba, a massacre which took place during the Nigerian Civil War, which you and I are now going to talk about. And I'd like to put some background to this as we begin, Emma, because you yourself are an orphan of that massacre.
That's correct.
And as well as being the author of this book. How important is it to you and the other survivors, people of the Asaba region, that this book has been published, that it's been written? What does it mean?
Okay, it means a lot. In fact, if you go back, sequence it in the UN Article 2 of the Geneva Convention, It has been my fulfillment that it happened to the people of Asaba, and more than 40 years after it has happened, nobody has been able to come out with the true story, the true account of what happened to these people. They are not Biafrans, They are Nigerians. Mm-hmm. And then because it has been carpeted officially, despite the different investigations, in fact, the government of Nigeria had a white paper on this genocide, right? In 1969, But we haven't have. There's no publication of that.
So this
continues. And look at it. We are now in after Rwanda, Darfur. We are now in Kenya, almost the same.
Well, I'm going to bring Kenya up, but you make the most important point. This is four decades later. So we're finally getting this very thorough account, thanks to your work. I should also point out, as we start our conversation, that Asaba, the town which is the focus of the massacre, or how do you pronounce it, Asaba?
Asaba is correct.
Asaba is correct, I got it right.
You do well.
Thank you. But Asaba itself is a center of a civilization, a culture, which began in the 14th century.
That's right.
So it has very ancient roots.
Yes.
Therefore, my question to you, Emmanuel, is, did the horror that we saw in 1967, the massacre, was it somehow, were there tensions, ethnic tensions, going back for centuries, or were the events solely the result of the actions in 1967?
The Asaba massacre is a classic case. It's a classic case of what is happening in Africa, especially when you look at Africa from the conflicts that emanate or issues centering on tribes, probably disharmony of cultures. So the Asaba massacre was the end product of what has been happening over the years. We are talking about the Igbo nation. Mm-hmm. As I said, Asaba was never in Biafra, geographically, but it was an Igbo town. In fact, it was the first Igbo town that the federal troops entered in October 7, 1967. And when you're talking about Igbos, you're talking about great philosophers like Nnamdi Azikiwe, the man who made Mandela. Well, when Mandela came out from prison, he needed to see three people. Gaddafi, because of the support Libya gave him. Fidel Castro of Cuba.
Of course.
For reasons you know, the Cuban doctors, they have been all over in Africa, in Angola, I saw them. Then for Nnamdi Azikiwe, he said he wanted to see Nnamdi Azikiwe because Azikiwe was the one who he lived in his house when Azikiwe was publishing the West African Pilot in Lagos.
So this is very, very important.
And you're talking about people like Dick Tiger. Even here in America, you're talking about the man who served the George Bush cabinet as the assistant secretary of health that was in the cover of the magazine.
Yeah, I know.
So and the first black man who could have been the Pope, Cardinal Reza. These are the Igbo history.
A lot of talented people, this is clear. But let me, now I want to reinforce something you said actually a minute ago, because Asaba, as you just pointed out, was not part of the Biafran secession.
No.
And it, but it is a town, as you've just indicated, that is a center of Igbo culture, a very talented people. So it's very interesting that this massacre would take place in Asaba, a town which had not been part of the secession revolt. I think we're going to focus on that as we get in the conversation. I want to ask you one more background question, so to speak. You dedicate this book to a lot of very prominent people, among them Oprah Winfrey, Ted Kennedy, Steven Spielberg, Colin Powell, many others. I'm just interested in the reaction. Has there been any reaction from people of this rank or caliber to the book, or to have they been helpful in any way, or is that an effort to get them to be helpful?
This is the beginning. It has not been easy, as you know, in the history of exposing genocide. It's, it's part of the involvement that once genocide is not exposed. Mm-hmm. Or when it's exposed, you are offering yourself to a lot of risk. Mm-hmm. In Nigeria, the book was the bestseller, but we couldn't find the book. Something happened to the book. Nobody knows whether somebody bought the whole copies we were able to print. Now, we came over to America because during the Nigerian Civil War, most of the people who got involved, people who flew, the risky planes to come in to save the children, were Americans. They came in here and joined the missionaries from Canada, especially Reverend Johnson. And that was the greatest joint church aid to Africa that started with Biafra, before Rwanda, before Darfur. It was in answer to your question, we started with Woodrow Wilson because we know this is the intellectual capital. By the time we ended up, we shall be in Oprah Winfrey because that's where the whole world will. Because this genocide that has been carpeted over the years must see exposure so that the victims will see at last bury their victims.
Well, this is important so that the victims get their justice. That is, of course, the purpose of this book, the cause you serve. I'm very heartened by something you just said, and that is that I got the impression Americans have been positively involved over these past several decades. That's really good to hear.
And there haven't been anybody, even on the Biafran side, that has been able to say thank you. We expected people like Colonel Ojukwu, people from the other side that were on the humanitarian side to come out years after, because most Biafran children are still in Gabon, they are still in Congo, they are still in Ivory Coast.
So what do you mean there's the diaspora caused by the suffering that spread the population in many countries? Let me ask you this, because obviously I think in the minds of people watching us right now, I'm sure that anyone watching I would hope is gripped by this story, it's that important. The obvious question is, why does this start? You know, why does the Nigerian army do this? And it seems to me, and let me get you a brief answer on this if I might, as you mentioned before, Asaba is in the Midwestern States region. It's not a part of the revolt, but the Biafrans do invade it first, do they not?
Okay.
Now tell me briefly what happens. What makes the Nigerians want to attack
it? Asaba was the first capital of Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Remember, the British, during the colonial period, the British were able to control and rule their colonies through the indirect rule system, as opposed to the French that had the assimilation policy, where they are totally engaged. Some black people go to the French parliament, Ivory Coast president, Senegal, Senghor, they were all there. But in British-controlled territories like Nigeria, they were involved in a system that were called indirect rule system.
Indirect rule.
Yes, indirect rule. So Asaba, by the turn of the century, 1900, was the capital of Nigeria because of the charter given to the trading companies like Royal Niger Company, and you had the East African company, the Borno Company, and the South African. Mm-hmm. So these are the areas how the British control their colonies, which are taking responsibility if those trading companies went awry with their government. Mm-hmm. And they could save a lot of money when they used the charter to control this area. So these Royal companies engage in trade, the sale of palm products, the timber, and the rest of resources, without taking responsibility of government. And they were given charter to organize their own police. So they had Asaba as the capital of the Royal Niger Company in Nigeria, with the defense headquarters in Lokoja, in northern Nigeria. So Asaba maintained that strategic importance because it was the link between the East African countries. There was the rail and the motor continental railway from the west to the east. Asaba was the strategic city on the Niger.
So Asaba becomes then, because of all this power and this history, and because it's the center of the indirect rule, the major trading capital, a very powerful place, very attractive place, I would suppose, and a very threatening place, perhaps, to the central government.
That's right. So during the Civil War, the Biafrans had serious incursion coming from their northern borders by the Nigerian 1st Division. So in order to relax the advance of the federal troops and to Enugu and the northern fringes, they decided to invade the Midwestern state.
Where Asaba is.
Yes, and went all the way. They were almost taking over Lagos before the 2nd Division reorganized and they pushed them back.
Okay.
So on getting to Asaba, the first Igbo town, because the other areas were, and again, the leader of this 2nd Division, that later became the head of state, Murtala Mohammed, had his own mindset. So so our fulfillment that through the book, and even after we wrote the book, people didn't believe much. But the head of state, General Yakubu Gowon, came to Asaba to apologize to the people. But that's not enough.
Well, okay, we'll talk about his apology in a moment because that's the aftermath. And as you say, his apology after the fact wasn't enough. But I want to focus right now on the event.
So
the Biafrans have invaded and been pushed back. The Nigerian army comes through.
Yes.
They attack Asaba, and we get the massacre. Now, this massacre, which is obviously the principal part of this book, the reason you and I are talking, is striking, Emmanuel, for its brutality. And one of the book, I mean, there are example personal testimony you have here. You know, this person's experience, that person's experience, so much of it. Many questions. One of them is this: why is that so brutal? I mean, it's more than just killing. They seem to be operating with a list of people to kill, and some of the killing is done in such a way as to make it as horrific as possible, amputating limbs and so forth, leaving people to be attacked by dogs. And why?
Yes, because Asaba produced the premier of the then Midwestern state.
Okay.
In the name of Dennis Osedebe, a very learned lawyer. And Asaba controlled the bureaucracy of the Midwestern state because they had the advantage of going to school before the other groups. Asaba, as I was saying, also produced the leader of the January 15 coup, Major Chukwuma Nzogwu. And these are the what was in the other in Murtala Mohammed's mind when he was approaching the town. And again, the people that came, why the genocide became so brutal and incomprehensible was that the people that came to welcome friendly federal troops who are supposed to protect them. Otherwise, they had the thinking to go over the bridge and go and into safety in the Biafran hands. But they believed they were Nigerian citizens, and they expected troops to protect them.
Let me repeat this, because this is the key, maybe the most chilling part of the book. as you point out, the Biafrans had you know, been forced back. The people of Asaba are welcoming, want to welcome the troops. And they give them a welcoming dance. There are parades, marches, all kinds of festivities. But that becomes a killing ground.
That's right.
That becomes the arena for death.
That's which of Asaba, that's the worst of it.
I mean, in addition to it being horrible, it's also an ultimate betrayal of the people's aspirations. It's a very ugly incident.
And that is why during the, after the massacre, there was no place exactly, because when you look at the, remember the Ukraine revolution of 2 weeks ago, the graves were moving because there were a lot of people who were thrown in there, buried alive. In our own case, the graves were too many. There were not a lot of places to bury people anymore, so they threw them into the River Niger. Yeah. And that is where I coined the word from the book, there was blood on the Niger.
Yeah. It's an extraordinary, you know, parts of it read like a novel, and it also reads like a police report, because you have the names of a lot of people involved in this, in all the roles they played. And I want to emphasize this, because it does personalize the suffering. For example, there are a couple of incidents I want to point out. In one of many, these are men, women, and children being killed. There's a boy, a little boy, who is dying, and he doesn't understand it. He says, as he is dying, he says, "Is this death? Is this how people die?" Those are his last words. But as he is dying, a soldier rolls a truck over him.
There's crushed his head.
I mean, that is, but those words are chilling. And then the act of, you know, murdering him beyond what has already been done. It's just.
And I want to add that probably I may not be able to write again. When I was writing all those lines and all those, especially the climax of the story on chapter 5, the dance of death, I don't know what happened to me. I've been reading this book. Sometimes I read it before coming here, I read it again. I couldn't believe I was the one writing because I don't think I'll be able to have the inspiration or the passion to gather in the words and express myself in so much passion ever. This is impossible to me. Anytime I go back to read the lines of this book, and then people are saying that we should forget this. I don't understand it.
No.
Up to now, the people of Asaba are so frightened. They are so in stupor. They don't discuss this. Majority don't discuss this. Only few of us have taken the gauntlet. And we are going to go anywhere to make sure that this first genocide of black people is moved away from the carpet that it is also for now. That's why we're here, sir.
You know, the people who tell you to forget it are absolutely wrong. I mean, if you forget it, it's going to happen again. That's what the world has proven. I don't know if I have to, let me see if I have a moment at least to quote this. I mentioned the little boy who died. There's also an old man, Diokpa, and it reads like Greek tragedy. As they're killing him, he says, he tells the soldiers, go ahead and kill me. Complete your murderous assignment. Do it. You know, you're killing me. By my customs and traditions, the people lying on the ground are answerable to me. These are the other victims. And I feed them from that exercise of authority over them. I called them out for this meeting. Having wiped them out, which you have done, life has no meaning to me any longer. The soldiers obliged him and killed him. Those words could come from Greek tragedy.
Yes.
They could be written by Sophocles. Well, let's go to the aftermath. At some point, this is over as it has to be. The war itself is over, that we all know. In the aftermath, when Nigeria has resolved this war, were the people of Asaba, you in particular and others, were you satisfied with the government's response? Was there a sufficient acknowledgement, acceptance of responsibility, an apology, whatever was said and done from General Gowon and the others that was at least minimally responsive?
There was still a silence of the cemetery.
A silence?
Immediately after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And it was many years later that we started putting on pressure. Mm-hmm. And you must have read about our own Truth and Justice
Commission.
Yes. Headed by a Supreme Court Judge, Justice Oputa. And that was like during the Obasanjo's regime. Mm-hmm. That was one of his landmarks in office, trying to see reconciliation come to different people. But as I'm talking to you now, mm-hmm. I was the one that led my people's representation to that tribunal in Enugu. And this commission went around the country from Lagos, Enugu, Kaduna. Every group had their own say. But as I'm talking to you now, we have not seen any white paper.
No white paper, yes. No final report. No,
unlike the South African mm-hmm. commission that was headed by...
When was the commission?
That was during the first 4 years of General Obasanjo.
Uh-huh. Which would be...
That was probably 2003, mm-hmm. 2004.
4 or 5 years ago. Yes,
mm-hmm. Nothing. And it looks like the same group that over the years have forestalled any mm-hmm. exposure of this crime against humanity that work. Mm-hmm. Because they always maintain the high levels of government, either in the military, the military is extending their power into governance.
Has any outside group, I think of the United Nations or any other particular, Amnesty International, called for that report? Or issue or pressured?
Not within my.
Would it be helpful if they did?
But I'm aware mm-hmm. that the Nobel laureate, Wole Soyinka, who has been mm-hmm. in your program, if you read his book, this is one of the reasons why he was incarcerated for many years during the Civil War. Mm-hmm. He's not Igbo, he's Yoruba. And he's supposed to have been against the Biafrans, mm-hmm. but he stood up. Mm-hmm. And he wrote. He wrote about the Asaba massacre in one of the chapters of his best book, The Man Died.
Yes.
And I quoted him here, mm-hmm. and he's living. He said he's not yet dead. Mm-hmm. And the other sources mentioned this government commission that was instituted, not by the Biafrans, not after the war, but during mm-hmm. the war, mm-hmm. after the butcher, mm-hmm. Murat Ali Mohammed, did what he did at Asaba. Mm-hmm. The federal government instituted a commission to investigate this Asaba crisis. And then it has its white paper, but we haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. So but we're looking to see if what we got. But finally, there is a French group under Kojo Mensah, mm-hmm. United Nations French group. I don't know particularly, I don't know. But they looked into it, and we have their papers about this.
But what you have then, you have Wole Soyinka, one of the world's most respected
yes.
writers, novelists, intellectuals, and you have French groups and various private groups that are making this pressure, but you still do not have the official government paper.
No, but you know, there's always a problem. You cannot contest for genocide mm-hmm. when you are not a sovereign state.
Yeah, that's right.
But then there are several issues different. Mm-hmm. Why the Biafrans have their tall stories mm-hmm. against Nigeria, because they are Igbos, it started from 1950s, pogrom, then developing into genocide. Probably we like to differentiate on the term pogrom and genocide.
Yeah, but you know, this is part, Emmanuel, as you well know, this is part of a very important debate that should be going on in the world right now, because as you mentioned in this book, the importance of understanding Asaba is all to understand also to understand Kosovo,
yes.
Burundi, Rwanda, all these other places. And I think the message to me, at least in part, is we've got to start thinking much more rigorously about what genocide is and how the world has to respond to it.
Yes.
The old ways won't do.
Yes, but the Asaba case becomes a caveat. Mm-hmm. It is not a sovereign state. Mm-hmm. It didn't go into secession. Mm-hmm. It was a loyal citizens of your own territory. Mm-hmm. So where do you place Asaba?
Yeah.
The Igbos of the East say, or if there's an argument that, oh, you went to war, anything can happen during the war, what about your own citizen?
Yeah, but see, that's the point. Let me repeat that. It's your own citizens in their own country.
Yes.
They're trying to welcome troops who are going
yes.
to kill them, okay? Now, but the interesting debate in the world right now, I think, at least I hope it is, and it's written up in some important papers, the need to have the right to intervene in nations where these things are going on within the borders, you know? that it's happening in one town or one region,
yes.
But the it has to be treated internationally. This is, I think, an important.
I stand in the argument also. You can, in the case of Rwanda, mm-hmm. or in the case of Uganda or Darfur, you say those citizens carried up arms against the government, mm-hmm. like in southern Sudan. You can, mm-hmm. you can argue.
They were in revolt.
Yes, they were in revolt. Mm-hmm. Like the Biafrans were in revolt, mm-hmm. whatever reasons mm-hmm. they have.
Mm-hmm. But the Asaba
people had no guns. They came to welcome you,
yeah.
to say you are supposed to protect them.
That's what I mean. That is
the paradox.
That's the paradox. Mm-hmm. Above all else, beyond its ugliness, its brutality, is its irony, the fact that they were there to welcome people who killed them. I want to, as we come close to the end of our program, point this. This is what you do now. You have this magazine.
Yes, I
it's quite a magazine.
Thank you very much.
You publish this here in this country?
Yes, I publish as part of the bringing in the international market of ideas, not only to worry about Africa, but to engage the African new thought that democracy doesn't have to end with elections.
Oh, we need that thought here. we can use that
thought. Our African way of life, the consensus way of that Julius Nyerere talked about, mm-hmm. then the coming of the military, and of course what is happening now, not only in Nigeria, Kenya, and down the line. Why is it that anytime we have elections, mm-hmm. we're always going to end up in a crisis? Do we need elections? Do we have to spend the whole money on elections, and at the end, nothing happens out of elections?
That's the question for Africa, a question for us, is a question for the world. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
I think you helped a lot of people understand a lot of things. Thank you, Emmanuel.
It's terrific coming here, and I will continue doing your good job.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Emma Okocha. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Sharana Harris, and our assistant producer is Keila Jackson. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars.